Lisa Withers is no architect. She's not concerned with design, the feng shui of a room, or anything like that. But for the last year or so, she's been all about buildings and spaces all around North Carolina. Buildings that are still around from long ago, spaces where buildings used to be.
I've taken so many pictures of parking garages, parking lots, open fields. And even in last week when I was talking, working with a particular community member in Fayetteville, I was like, we were standing in a grassy lot where the Bedford Inn once stood. And I was like, driving by here today, you have never known that on this space is where Ella Fitzgerald stayed. Duke Ellington, all of when they came through Fayetteville.
Withers, a PhD student in the public history program, is a detective of sorts. She's researching the North Carolina sites that appeared in the Green Book. It was a yearly publication from 1936 to the mid-1960s that provided African-American travelers information about places like the Bedford Inn in Fayetteville, restaurants, hotels, gas stations, places along the way they knew would welcome them in the Jim Crow era and during the hardships of the Civil Rights Movement. So far, Withers, who is working with a team from the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission on the project, has identified more than 300 of those sites, a number that Withers describes as fluid because of the very nature of how the Green Book was composed.
Part of my job is, as I do more research into these different sites, realizing like, oh, these two entries are really the same one. Because also, so one of the ways in how I describe the Green Book is an early form of crowdsourcing. And also, if you're in New York, you're not going to know the landscape and all the different communities across. You really are relying on what people submit. And so there are a lot of errors in the Green Book itself as a primary source document. So that's why with the number, it keeps changing.
So a lot of what Withers does is being a sleuth, finding those structures, locating the what used to be's, and capturing the stories of those spaces, sorting these things out, so to speak.
For example, here in Raleigh, I realized the other week that there is two different entries for a Peerless Dry Cleaners, two different addresses, one on Jones Street, one on Fayetteville Street. And as I keep going through city directories, I'm realizing, wait, this is a chain. The main office was on Jones Street, but there was a branch on Fayetteville Street, and it just so happened that there are two entries for the same business.
I'm Chris Saunders, Associate Editor of NC State Magazine, and today on Hear the How, Lisa Withers and her quest to sort things out. She explains what led her to searching, provides a nice history of the Green Book, reveals some of her interesting finds, and previews what she and the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission plan to do in March with all the research they've gathered in the North Carolina Green Book Project. Hint, they could be coming to a town near you, so stay tuned. Episode 15, Space Stories. Withers is funny when locating her hometown.
Technically, I was born in Danville, Virginia, but it's right across the state line for where I grew up in Ruffin, North Carolina. It's a very small tobacco community. Because most people have never heard of Ruffin, I typically say Reedsville, which is our postal address for my family. But for everyone who also has never heard of Reedsville, I then say Greensboro.
So if we say Rockingham County, that should work, especially since it's the place that really shaped Withers' passion for public history. After graduating from UNC Chapel Hill with a degree in African American Studies, she started volunteering at a new museum there that had just opened. It's called the Museum and Archives of Rockingham County. Basically, it houses the county's historical society, significant artifacts, documents, and such.
The thing that I loved the most about my first job working at a museum was interacting with community members. And that's really where I started identifying and really started developing this core motivation, core drive that I have of really working with community members, not only to share stories, but to preserve those stories as well.
The story of the Green Book begins with necessity. Withers explains.
So Sundown Town is one of several reasons for the existence of the Green Book. And so essentially Sundown Towns were places, whether it's communities, most of the time smaller, more rural spaces, in which it was part of legal code or if not also social custom, where if the sun sets, if you are a person who has any African ancestry, you better be out of those town limits, those city limits. And oftentimes being caught within those municipality limits was cause for jail or worse sometimes, yes. And sometimes you may not know until you go and you find yourself in that situation at that particular place it was a sundown town. It's not like all the time they would have a sign that says, this is a sundown town. So that's why the Green Book would have been really helpful.
A Harlem postal worker and traveler himself, Victor Greene saw and understood that. So in 1936, he put out the first edition. And even in the first couple, Greene saw that crowdsourcing, as Withers calls it, would be an asset.
The first two editions really are only on New York and the New York metropolitan area, but it caught on quickly because I mentioned he was a postal worker, and that's a wide network that he could already start working with. And then eventually, especially in the backs of early editions, you see a whole sheets of paper where you can just tear off and write down the name and address and send it in and submit it in. And so that's another way in how eventually the booklet grew.
It also grew in its reach.
I think within the first 5 years or so of its publication, for it to have a good section of the United States, and then eventually grew, I believe it does have all 48 continental United States, but it's also international as well. Particularly as you get into the late 50s and the 1960s, you have countries from England, Britain to Nigeria, Central and South American countries represented in there. So it is also an international book as well.
So the Greene Book in North Carolina. Withers, who also has a degree in history and museum studies from UNC Greensboro, and her team began by going through each edition of the Greene Book, which is available through the New York Public Library, a large selection of them anyways. They spotted the listings and found the addresses. Then they go out and check to see what's there.
Some entries in the Greene Book are just, it's on the corner of Cabarrus and Dawson Street. Great, there are four corners to that street. So where exactly at that intersection was that located? And so I'm taking what is in the Greene Book as a primary source and going through other sources, records, city directory, deeds, working with community members, and identifying what exactly was this specific entry. And then after verifying all that, we're taking pictures in the modern day because we're kind of also doing then and now.
Thus far, Withers and her team have identified 326 sites in North Carolina. Only between 60 to 65 of those are still standing. That absence, those holes, filling in the stories of those spaces, Withers sees that as a piece to a much larger conversation.
So many African-American communities, unfortunately, buildings have been torn down. You know, as we continue to advance as a society, you know, being able to participate in those conversations about whether or not, where should we build, what are policies that would be helpful in making those decisions moving forward, and understanding the role that these spaces play, but also not just physical space, but spaces within our lives and our communities, I think can help us to make more informed decisions moving forward.
And that means conversations Withers has through her recording oral histories of members in the communities where those buildings stand or stood. People who lived through and felt the smothering of Jim Crow laws and who have heard other family members tell stories of their experiences.
I'm engaging with a generation that are the last to really go through that era, especially how we think about it and define it. But then many of them are also the children, the grandchildren of the people who are active participants in fighting against those laws, social customs, if you will, that were intended to make African Americans be second-class citizens within the United States.
Withers' research has involved two types of conversations, in fact.
One series of conversations I'm having with community members is, what were some of the experiences they personally had themselves, or stories that have been passed down through their families about movement and travel and what that was like for community members? And then also, even for community members because a lot of them are like, well, I've never traveled anywhere. Okay, that could be true, but with the places that are here, this was in the community. And so a lot of community members remember the people who were owners of these businesses. They remember and the roles that they had in their communities.
Those conversations have led her to places like the Bedford Inn in Fayetteville.
Last week I had the opportunity to interview the granddaughter of one of the women who owned the Bedford Inn in Fayetteville, Miss Osha Smith. And it comes to find out, Miss Smith, she was just so well known because, one, she was a classically trained pianist. And so she went to the Hans Conservatory. She was trained as a pianist. And one of the things she did for decades was give piano lessons. And so even before I sat down with the interview with the granddaughter, I had already encountered community members who remember taking piano lessons with Miss Smith. And they had stories about how she was.
Raleigh's Lewis Hotel, or Deluxe Hotel, depending on when someone stayed there.
So it's things like that that I'm still sorting through, figuring out. And eventually, you know, that's just something a conversation we have to have with our larger team is how exactly are we going to count these things? Because you can also count another example here in Raleigh is at the address 220 East Cabrera Street is what was known as the Lewis Hotel. Miss Hattie J. Lewis, she and her husband built a two-story brick building that became one of two official brick-and-mortar hotels, the other being the Arcade on Hargett Street here in Raleigh. But when her niece, Miss Griswold, took over the business in 1950, she changed the name to the Deluxe Hotel. So same building, same business, same address, but different name.
And to the supposed doorsteps of the Nile Congo in Raleigh.
It was listed here in Raleigh in the 1950s, that decade of the Green Book. And I know it's on Garner Road. Everyone's like, yeah, it was on Garner Road. But I'm like, where on Garner Road? So I'm still looking at for the exact land location where it stood, but it was a drive-thru. And I've had more than one Raleigh community members to be like, yes, and they had the best fried chicken, the best chicken sandwiches, hot dog, like, just talking about it, you can tell on people's faces, like, they can just remember eating the food. It's like, it was that good.
Withers tells one story after another when talking about her research with the North Carolina Green Book Project. And she and the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission are about to share those stories with the public. In March, they will start rolling out all of the team's research. One way they'll do this is with public programming, so keep your eyes open if they are heading to a community near you. You'll also be able to catch a traveling exhibit that they will be rolling across the state, bringing the museum to you, so to speak. And they will launch an interactive website that will feature all of the North Carolina sites that were listed in the Green Book. Please visit the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission's website at aahc.nc.gov to get more information on the when and where's of what will be a tremendous project here in 2020. And it's a project that represents everything Withers appreciated in that job back at the Museum and Archives of Rockingham County in her hometown.
It's been a multi-year journey, but through that process, I really have come to realize that for me, I truly love the preservation of knowledge, but also the creation of new knowledge and doing that with community members.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Hear the Howl today, and a special thanks to Lisa Withers for coming in for an interview and talking to us about her work with the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission on the North Carolina Green Book Project. I hope that you'll get out to see the project when it comes to your town and visit the website to learn more about these establishments that offered some hope to the African American community during the time of institutional racism in our country. You can read more about Withers' work in the current issue of NC State Magazine. That's the fall issue. It's still out. However, next month, the upcoming winter issue should be in your mailboxes, so stay tuned for the stories that we will have to go along with for that one. Special thanks to Sylvia Adcock for always reading and editing these stories. And a note here, the producer who has sat beside me in all of the recordings, done all the editing, found great music and sound effects, suggested story ideas, you know, done it all, has left. Morgan Holcomb left the Alumni Association back before Christmas. But it's good news for her. She's now an assistant director of marketing for the Jenkins MBA program. So join me in wishing her well. She did a lot to bring this podcast to you all and has been an equal part of it alongside me since we started this back in 2017. But we have good news. Molly Donovan, a social media specialist in university communications here at NC State, is joining us as the producer. You've seen her work before. She crafts all the social media posts for the Alumni Association. And if you've made it to this point, you've heard her work. She produced this one, her first episode. She did a great job, don't you think? So listen out for us as Molly and I set out to bring you stories for this podcast, Season 3, whose first episode will drop next month. We'll take you to Kenya in that one. We'll see you next time on Hear the Howl.